wherever you're listening in the world, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Israelcast, the show that brings you interesting people doing fascinating work all over Israel. I'm Stephen Shalowitz, and on this episode, we were joined on the line via Skype by Paul Nirens. Paul is the founder of Galileet, which offers culinary adventures in the Galilee, including cooking classes and cooking tours. Now, in our conversation, Paul shares what makes the Galilee such a unique destination, plus his love for the region, its food, and bringing people together. So, hope you've come hungry to enjoy our conversation now with Paul Nirens. Welcome to Israelcast, Paul.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you aboard. We've got lots of ground to cover when it comes to food in the Galilee. And I should say, in preparation for our conversation today, I had great fun because I do love both. I love the Galilee. I love travel. But I also love food, and I know you do too. So we're going to dig in, pun intended, of course. I really, though, want to first start up by asking you, Paul, what do you think people would be most surprised to learn about the Galilee? You've been there for years now, but for those that aren't familiar with the region, what would they be most surprised to learn?
Well, they might be surprised to hear that there are no big cities. Of all the cities in Israel, not any of the 30 biggest cities in Israel are in the Galilee. So the largest town in the Galilee is only 60,000 people. So that's something that even I find a bit surprising. But then again, maybe we shouldn't be surprised because the Galilee is Israel's rural north. And so therefore, we're not built up like Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or Beersheba or Haifa or wherever.
Well, people think of Israel, funny enough, as a desert country, or many people do, many that aren't familiar with Israel. But the Galilee is anything but. It's Israel's Provence or it's Israel's Tuscany.
I'm not sure if I like that term. Tuscany is Tuscany. Provence is, Provence is Provence. And the Galilee is very different. The makeup of the people is very different. The raw materials are very different. I understand the comparison because it is Israel's breadbasket. But you've got to remember that 100 years ago, in the Galilee as well, it was, I don't know if about desert, but it was certainly not as vital and not as rich as what it is today. In terms of its raw produce and stuff. And so it has become more like, I guess, Tuscany or Provence, but I prefer to say it's the Galilee.
Right. Well, of course, we're metaphorically speaking, aren't we?
To give people a
frame of reference, Paul, because, again, many people might not be familiar with the Galilee. Of course, many will know it from the Bible, certainly, but from a topographical perspective or just from a lifestyle perspective, it has that ease, that a feel of a Tuscany or a Provence, right? Because it is very rural. As you said, there aren't any big cities up there.
No, there's no question that you're right about that. That is, it's away from the hustle and bustle of mainstream Israel. We laugh in Israel, in fact, that Israel sometimes between Hadera and Gadera. Hadera is a town just south of Haifa, and Gadera is another town that's south of Tel Aviv, and that's basically where everything happens in Israel. It's in some ways meant to be an insult to the north, but I actually take it as a compliment because we are different. We are more relaxed. It's more countrified, and I'm quite happy with that. In fact, I love it. And we have the best food, of course.
Well, we're going to get to the food in a second. It does have a very unique ethnic mix, an ethnic blend, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. You've got, Israel as a country, of course, is the ingathering of the exiles. And so you've got in the north, just as you have as a Jewish population in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or anywhere else, but then added into that mix, of course, you've got the non-Jewish population. 50% of the population in the north is not Jewish. And so that makes up for a very different ethnic mix in the north. So you've got, let's say, Sephardi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews and Ethiopian Jews and all that. But then again, you've also got the Arabic-speaking population. And within that, you've got the Druze and you've got the Muslims and then you've got Bedouins and you've got Christians. And so it really is very, very diverse, the population. The population in the north, I think, is more diverse than anywhere else in Israel. And we see it and we feel it.
And everybody gets along.
Well, that's one of the things that, the other thing that you said, what don't people know about the Galilee or what would surprise them? It's the lack of tension. Everyone really, it's not a cliche. It's not something that I'm going to wave a flag around. It's really the case.
Now, you told me in an email exchange, Paul, that you don't like the term coexistence. And you said that when we were going to speak, that you would explain that. So explain, my friend.
The word coexistence to me, both in Hebrew and English, but we're talking English, so I'll explain it in English, almost makes it sound as if we have to be together. We coexist because we have no choice. Okay, we exist together. And I don't feel that at all. In fact, I think the majority of people in the Galilee don't feel that at all. We live here as neighbors. I've been in Israel. I wasn't born in Israel, but I've been here for 30 years.
Originally from Australia, we should say. We could tell by the accent.
Yeah. I've been here for 30 years, and I still haven't lost it. There's nothing I can do about that.
Be proud of that accent,
but like I say,
Paul.
I actually hate it. I'll let you know a secret that no one else is listening to, I'm sure, that I actually hate the accent. But other people like it, so I guess I'll live with it. But going back to the whole thing of the term coexistence, I don't like it because, again, it makes us feel as if we're forced to exist together. And there's nothing being forced here. It's much more a case of I have neighbors, some of them I like, some of them I don't like, some of them are Jewish, some of them are Arab, and we live here together. And so that's much more living together is a much more accurate way of saying or of describing the life here in the Galilee rather than coexistence. I'm not quite sure if I made myself clear.
Well, I think you have, because what you're saying is just to exist is to exist, but to live together and to become true neighbors, that takes the relationship to a different level. I think that's what you're trying to say.
Absolutely, but I also you do understand me, and that I'm glad for that. But it's even more than that, because I actually see the term coexistence as being almost negative. It's almost as if, well, if we have to exist together, then we will. And that's certainly not the way I look at it.
You know, all right. Right. Well, that's actually a good segue, Paul, into food. Food is really a terrific uniter. So let's dive in right now. Let's dig in, as I said at the top of the show. Is there such thing, Paul, as a typical Galilean meal?
Well, I would sort of say that if it's got the local produce and there's so much fantastic local produce around, that would be your typical Galilean meal. Things that have olive oil in it, friket, which is wheat, which is smoked and harvested when it's still green, which actually comes from the days of the Bible. Bulgur wheat, which is, of course, what we might sometimes call cracked wheat. Anything with the seven species, you've got to remember that in the Bible, the seven species were mentioned, and they were principally grown in this area. All the way up to today, they're still grown in this area. So all those things make up a lot of the local food here. In the winter, it's very, very seasonal as well. In the winter, you'll have on the table a lot of local greens that grow wild. In the summer, you'll have summer vegetables. So an average Galilean meal is something that comes from within 10 miles of here. In fact, I'd like to say that there's a concept, I think, in America and Australia today, a farm to table, and it's a concept. People actually think about it. Whereas in the Galilee, we don't really think about it. That's just the way it is. Everything that you eat on your table is grown in the region, and it's not something we have to even mention.
And what about fruit?
Well, fruit is, there's a local market that I sometimes take guests to. Which is just a large local market, and I walk through it, and I'm just amazed at the quality and the variety of the fruit and vegetables. And so the fruit that's here is everything that, let's say, that you get in America, but just the quality is unparalleled. I've traveled through Spain, France, Italy, and, they're always known to be the great food capitals of the world, and I think that the raw products that we have in Israel, especially in the Galilee, are just as good as anything that you have there.
What makes the fruit so special there, then?
Well, a stupid answer. Yes, In other words, everything. We have, you know, so much sunshine. We have heat. We have great soil. And Israel as a country is a modern Western country. And so therefore the means to grow the local produce is as good as anywhere else in the world, the actual technology, if you want to call it that. So even when you're talking about the local food grown by someone in someone's backyard, then they've just got everything at their fingertips to make it better. And so so that's it. But yeah, it's a combination of the soil and the sun and the long summers, the mild winters, and a lot of tender loving care.
You can't beat the tender loving care, Paul. I'm on your website right now, Galilite, and we'll have the link to that on the show notes page of our website, jnf.org/IsraelCast. And I must say, I'm reluctant to go on one of your tours because I think I'm going to gain 1,000 pounds if I do. But then again, I say to myself, all of this is really healthy food that's being prepared and that you're showing people how to prepare. You have a Galilean cooking workshop. You have full-day culinary and cultural tours. You have wild green foraging. You can go into local people's homes and have them prepare a meal so that you don't have to go to a restaurant. You really run the gamut when it comes to providing culinary experiences for visitors to the Galilee, and I'm guessing also perhaps people that live in the Galilee or people that live in Israel.
Absolutely. I think the most important guiding principle of everything that you read and everything that I do is that it's built around locals. You know, we spoke a little bit about how much I like my neighbours. Some I like, some I don't like, but how much they are my neighbours, and how much I live in. You know, I've lived in the Galilee now for 30 years, and so my activities are also based around working with the people that I live next to. And I think that's what makes it interesting as well. You know, you can go to a restaurant in Tel Aviv, and there are fantastic restaurants in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem, as good as, you know, almost anywhere in the world. But what you can't get is the authentic experience of coming into somebody's home and having a meal that either you prepare yourself, if it's a cooking workshop, or have prepared for you if you're just on the road, or if you go on a culinary tour and you're going to a local winery that is just a boutique winery, or a goat's cheese dairy, or you go out into the fields and see how frika is made during the season. And these are things that I think people from both from overseas and from Tel Aviv don't have the opportunity to see. And I'm quite proud of the fact that I'm opening up the Galilee to everyone from around the world.
And the people that you're engaging with that are preparing the food, that are giving the cooking classes, that are going on these foraging forays, they come from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all religions, don't they?
Absolutely. I have host families that are Christians, Muslims, Druze, Bedouins. I have Jews, of course, as well that I work with. And they're all different. Their story is all different. But what is fascinating is someone that comes to the area and wants to really see what Israel is about, and obviously by extension what the Galilee is about, will come to someone's home, hear about who they are, taste their food, and will come out having understood a little bit more about the background of the person and understood a little bit more about the complexity but the good side of Israel.
I'm guessing also that many of the people with whom you're engaged in these culinary activities, they're not university educated, or they might not have gone to college, for example. They might have had more modest backgrounds. And so you're really giving them a sense of empowerment also by taking people, city slickers, if you will, into their homes and into their communities and having those visitors learn from them. So it's really a two-way street, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely a two-way street. When I started up the business, I was very much had the view of, let's say, the tourist. You know, how's he going to view it? And then that was obviously, you know, important to me, and it's still important to me. But over time, I've also come to see that my hosts, who, as you said, Most of them have barely finished 12 years of education. Many of the women, and you'll excuse the expression, have only brought up children, and that's, you know, I think it's a great thing, so please don't misunderstand me. But, you know, in their own eyes, they've never really worked out in a job. They've not gone ahead. And suddenly...
Well, they've had just one... Let's just say that they've had one career, and the career was child-rearing. Okay.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's a very important career. So, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood, but I think it's any less important than any other career. But by the same token, when I bring a Harvard professor or, you know, a New York lawyer into their homes, and suddenly my hosts have something to say, and these people who are educated, second, third degrees, you know, and they want to hear what my hosts have to say. They want to learn from my hosts. And so therefore, I think that it is very much, you mentioned empowerment, and it very, very much is an issue that they finish and they say, wow, you know, I'm worth something, which of course they are. But I'm glad that I'm giving them the tools to really make them feel good about themselves, to earn money. I still want to get away from the fact that the money is important. First of all, another thing that you may not know, that in the Galilee, tourism contributes to up to 70% of the workforce in the Galilee, in one way or another. It's a trickle-down effect. But certainly with my hosts, it's very direct, and that money is important to them. They're working-class families, and the money that they receive is important and is positive. I'm not just making money for myself. I'm making money for eight other families in the Galilee. And I think that I'm quite proud of that.
I want to get back to food in a second, but as long as you're bringing up development, you're part of the Western Galilee Now program. Can you talk to us about that and about companies, industries, about businesses that are finding the Galilee an attractive place to set up shop?
Absolutely. I've been very happy to talk about the Western Galilee Now project because it's fantastic. By the way, I would like to say it's fantastic, and we get a lot of help from the JNF, and we really do appreciate that support. It's all support that goes. It's not schnorrer. It's support that helps us help ourselves, and that's fantastic. And so the Galilee is developing. The Galilee is really moving forward like the rest of Israel, but in a way that if it's in tourism, and the Western Galilee Now Tourism Association very much takes people like me or that have small boutique businesses, and where the emphasis is on quality and is on providing value for money and something that's different to people who are coming up to the Galilee. So, like I say, you might come and do a cooking workshop with me. You might come and do a vegan workshop with someone else. You might go to a glass factory and see a world-renowned glass artist. There are fantastic restaurants, great wineries, dairies in the area. And so all these things together, it's almost like synergy. You know, by yourself, you can get to a certain level, but 1 + 1 + 1 equals much more than 3. And so that makes the whole area much more attractive, not just in terms of tourists, not just in terms of John Edelstein, who's coming from New York City, but also in terms of people coming up from Tel Aviv or people from within the area. You know, we don't feel like we're in a backwater. We can go out and we can go to, like I say, a great restaurant, or we can go and have wine, or we ourselves are locals. And so it's almost self-fulfilling in a positive sense, that because there's so many good things around, then more and more is happening. And that, I have to admit, is one of the great things about the Western Galilee Now Association, because we all help each other and work together and cooperate. And by doing that, we're making the area a better area.
That's your objective, really. I mean, at the end of the day, is to develop the area and to make it a thriving area. Or maybe I should say an even more thriving area.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And I think it's succeeding. It takes time. Nothing happens overnight. We'll go back to what you said in the very, very beginning, you know, about Tuscany. that if you go, if you went to Tuscany 40 years ago or 50 years ago, it was a backwater. And look at it, and look at it today. And I don't, I wouldn't necessarily want the Galilee to become Tuscany, because again, each has their own different personality. But the fact that that the Galilee has so much to offer, and we're just discovering what we do so well, and we're just learning how to present it to people from overseas or from within Israel even, and that's a great thing.
Well, that's actually the big challenge, is how do you present it? Because at the end of the day, you also don't want it to turn into a Disneyland. I mean, you have to retain the local essence of the place, don't you?
Yeah, I have no fear. I have to admit, I believe that, and all the people who are my friends in the Tourist Association believe the same thing, that if you're true to yourself and you continue doing the things that you believe in, then you won't become a Disneyland. Let that happen. You know, the city of Akko has gotten a lot of money from World Heritage and is becoming a tourism anchor. You know, the Rosh Hashanah Grotto has become a tourist anchor. That's great, and that's important. And if they bring people up here because they want to see the grottos, or they want to see Crusader castles, or you know, or whatever, but then that's fantastic, because that's part of what the Galilee has to offer. But I think a lot of the smaller businesses, if they stay true to themselves, then it won't lose its identity. If anything, the opposite is true. The identity of the Galilee will become stronger, and it won't become that Disneyland that you talk about.
I want to go back to food then.
That's a great idea.
Isn't that a great, always great topic to talk about?
I'm with you on
Are
that.
You surprised, because you've been in Israel now for 30 years, are you surprised at how the whole food industry, the whole culinary industry has taken off in Israel, and how some of the world's top chefs have come from Israel? Does that surprise you at all?
No, to be honest. I think that the development is almost a natural development. Israel, if you look at Israel 15 or 20 years ago, it was a struggling, developing country. In the past 15 years, Israel has become a modern Western country, you know, with its own peculiarities, which we won't go into, but it's a modern Western country. Likewise, Israel's food, raw products, are as good as anywhere in the world. So therefore, if on the one hand you're a modern Western country, people have more money to spend on not just surviving but actually enjoying life, and you have great raw products. So therefore, and on the third part of that is that Israelis are very creative. Now you take those three things together, and it's not actually that surprising that the food scene in Israel is such a hot scene around the world, because of all that, because of the creativity, because of the great raw products. I'm glad that's the case. Obviously, as someone who, you know, comes from a food background and is dealing with food, I'm obviously very, very happy about that. But I can't say that it's that surprising.
Well, one of our previous guests here on IsraelCast, Lior Lev Sarkars, who is a fantastic chef, he's become the go-to spice guy here in the United States and certainly globally. And he hails from the Galilee and is, as I said, really the go-to spice guy anywhere around. And he's building a culinary institute in the Galilee. Do you see others cropping up there?
I don't know about others cropping up there. I actually listened to that podcast myself. It was fascinating. I'll let you in on a scoop. I'm going to get in contact with him, and I would actually like to work with him in one way or another, because I deal with it here on the ground. He's building something which sounds fantastic. So your podcast has actually led to something already, or will lead to something already, which is great.
We're glad we could make a shidduch here on IsraelCast.
Well, that would be great. That's one of the reasons why you do it and why I'm here, because I'd be very happy for that shidduch.
I have to tell you, Lior is just a wonderful, wonderful guy and super talented. And so we hope that you both do indeed speak and connect, and good luck to both you on that. Want to go back, though, 30 years, as we talk about your being in Israel for 30-odd years. What brought you there in the first place?
It's not so popular to say today, and I don't know why, but I guess you'd call it Zionism. I grew up in a Zionist youth movement. I went to a Jewish school in Melbourne. When I finished my high school studies, I came on a year program here in Israel, came back a second time. Third time I stayed, went and made Aliyah to a kibbutz. Then I met my wife, who in Israel, but she's from Boston. We settled down together, had four kids, and that's it. And I'm not sorry for a second.
Did you settle in the Galilee to begin with?
Yep, absolutely. I came first of all to a place called Yasur, which is in the Western Galilee. I'm very much a person of the Western Galilee. I didn't really like it there. It was all right, but it wasn't really. I couldn't see my future there. And as I say, I met my wife, and she was living on this small hilltop community in the middle of nowhere. And I joined her in this small hilltop community in the middle of nowhere. After not so long, we got married. And ever since I've been in Israel, I've only been in the Galilee. And I couldn't imagine myself living anywhere else.
Now, in another email exchange that you and I had, I thought to myself, we're probably kindred spirits, because going back to this whole food issue, I don't like to use the word foodie. And you said that you didn't either, and that you would also tell me in our conversation why you don't like the word foodie. So you tell me first why you don't like it, and I'll tell you why I don't like it.
Oh, God, how do I do it without sounding like a snob? The word foodie is just, it doesn't really say anything. It's bland, you know. It gives you a tag, and puts you into a little box, which at least for myself, I can't speak about anyone else, but at least for myself, I don't feel like that I'm in that box. I like to say that I'm certainly a traveler. I'm a food adventurer, which I think is a much more accurate term, because I like to try lots of different things, but doesn't make me just the term foodie leaves me cold.
See, I think foodie sounds actually very snobbish. Yeah. That it implies somebody that only will buy a $150 bottle of olive oil, for example. And I can tell you, as someone who has traveled to very far-flung lands, who has seen a lot of poverty and who's seen malnutrition up close, the snobbishness for me of the word foodie, it just doesn't sit well. So I prefer not to use that. I mean, here in New York City, for example, I'd love to go to a good diner. And I don't know if necessarily a foodie would walk into a diner, or they might not admit walking into a diner. So for me, it's all about the snobbishness that word carries. So I'm not a big fan of it, but I really, really like that word, or the double word that you use, food adventurer. Is that what you said?
Yeah, food adventurer.
Yeah, I really like that, because it implies that you want to try everything and that you're open to new ideas and new concepts, and you're not going to look down on something.
Absolutely.
No, high-end, no question. High-end or low-end?
I do. I beg your pardon?
I said high-end or low-end.
Oh, absolutely. In many ways, it's what I do every day. I bring people into people's homes, and the food that they make themselves, if it's a cooking workshop, is peasant food. And I say peasant food in the most positive sense that could be imagined, as to say that it's real local food and there is nothing snobbish about it. And if someone would think that in order for food to be good, it has to have, as you say, you know, $150 bottles of
olive oil.
Then believe me, the olive oil that comes from the trees of my hosts, which costs about $8 for a bottle of olive oil, is as good as any olive oil you're going to have anywhere in the world.
Ingredients are key. In fact, going back to our episode with Lior Lev Sarkars, he talks all about ingredients and the importance of ingredients. So ingredients are important, but they don't have to cost $150 a bottle for olive oil.
The opposite.
Right. Cookbook. You have a cookbook coming up, don't you?
Yep. It's the right thing to do in terms of I'm writing a cookbook, co-writing with an English food journalist. And basically all the host families that I work with, we're taking their recipes. and their life stories, including who they are. And also we're putting into the book a lot of information about the local ingredients. Again, if it's freakier, yeah, if it's the winter greens, if it's the winter thistles like the wild artichokes, the olive oil, the seven species that we spoke about, and all that's going to go into the book as well. So it's almost going to be anthropological, not in the academic sense of studying anthropology at a university, but it's going to be anthropological in the sense that it's just going to cover not just food, it's going to cover the people of the Galilee. It's going to cover the raw ingredients of the Galilee. And so, yeah, I'm actually really looking forward to it. And I'm, even though it's not out yet, I'm already quite proud of it.
And when can we expect it, Paul?
Before Christmas. We should be printing.
Before the end of the year 2017.
Absolutely. We're printing the beginning of November. And so most certainly it'll be out, we'll be on Amazon already by the end of the year.
Well, I love on your website, you say, quote, "If it's edible and from the Galilee, then I know about it, and I want to share that experience with you," unquote. I hope you remember saying that, Paul. And really, so we wish you lots of good luck with all that you do and with bringing people to the Galilee to not only see the beauty of the Galilee, but also to understand and to really enjoy the great bounty of food that is found in the Galilee. So we want to thank you for joining us here on IsraelCast.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I enjoyed it, and it was great talking to you, and thanks very much.
We'll see you in the Galilee.
Absolutely. When you get here, you're going to come and do one of my tours.
You got a deal. Take care.
See you, mate.
Well, if you're like me, I bet you worked up an appetite there listening to our conversation with Paul Nirens. We do hope you check out his website, galileat.com. That's galileat.com. And you can also check it out on the show notes page of our website, jnf.org/IsraelCast. Well, we do release new episodes of IsraelCast every other Wednesday. And just so you never miss an episode, subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Simply search for IsraelCast. And while you're at it, do rate and review us to make it easier for more folks around the world to find us. Or you can always enjoy the show by visiting us at our website. Once again, it's jnf.org/IsraelCast. Now it takes a whole moshav to put IsraelCast together, and for that we thank Vivian Grossman, Alicia Yaffe, Miriam Braun, and Greg Weber. Jay Rothman and Roman Molino-Dunn from Mirror Tone Studios in the very heart of New York City are our editors, and the music that you hear at the top and tail of the program is titled My Eden. It's by the very talented Rafi Malkiel. It's from his album Water on the Tzadik label. IsraelCast is powered by JNF, Jewish National Fund, your voice in Israel. For more information about JNF, visit jnf.org. And if you'd like to write to us with story ideas or just to say hello, well, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at israelcast@jnf.org. Meantime, I'm Stephen Shalowitz, thanking you for tuning in and looking forward to having you join us on future episodes of IsraelCast.